You're listening to the Laugh Factory Podcast Network. For more shows, visit the podcast page at laughfactory.com.
It's the After Laugh, After Laugh. Welcome to the After Laugh, After Laugh, After Laugh. After Laugh, man. Go ahead, pull up a chair.
Hey, guys. Welcome to the After Laugh. I'm excited today. Have my buddy Joey Medina with me.
What's up?
What's up, man? I've known you for a while now, huh?
Yeah, we've known each other for a real long time.
At least maybe, gosh, 12 years when I first came here.
Yeah.
When did you do, now, I mean, you're a well-known comic. Mm-hmm. It's always weird, I don't know if people are famous or well-known, but your breakout was the original Latin Kings of Comedy.
Yeah, right? Yeah.
Now, and you were the youngest one in that crew.
Yeah,
right?
I was, actually.
How did that come about?
Long story.
Got a podcast, so go for it.
Okay, good. No. The way it kind of started was I met Paul Rodriguez in Tucson, Arizona. He was working, doing a gig.
What year was this? Do you remember?
Oh shit, man! I was an opening act still, so it was like,
so this, he was huge though.
Yeah, he was huge. This was his prime.
Yeah,
we did 7 sold out shows, and they asked me to come in, and I was so excited. I'm like, oh my god, I'm going to be opening up for Paul Rodriguez, and he. Of course, blew me off right away when I said hi. but
he's like, "You're not a hot girl." Moving on.
Yeah. So, but he was really nice to me, and afterwards, and then he actually found out they only paid me like $50 just to that was it. I got paid $50 to do 7 shows with him.
What?
It was Laughs Comedy Club, Gary
Jesus.
Bynum. Yeah, that's what it was. And I remember Gary telling me, "You would have done it for free." I'm like, "Yeah, but that's not the point,
yeah.
You know." But I think I would have done it for free. So Paul Rodriguez actually gave me a $100 bill.
Yeah.
And, when you're an opening act like 30 years ago, you're like, oh, my God, that's great, right? And I remember I said, I'll never spend this. And, of course, right away I have to eat, right? So I had to spend it. But I became friends with his manager, a guy named Scott Montoya at the time.
I know Scott.
Yeah. Good old Scott, right? So everybody's got a story about Scott. But so we became friends. And when I moved to L.A., Scott ended up managing me. So I ended up opening up for Paul a lot. I paid off all my credit cards. I made good money. I was like, man, this is great, man. I became, one of Paul's boys. And, I was working a lot. And then the Kings of Comedy came out with, Cedric and D.L. Hughley and all the other
Bernie
guys.
Right?
Yeah. And that did real well. And then Paul had an idea. He goes, well, let's do the Latin Kings of Comedy. And
also, the Kings of Comedy is one of the first, from what I remember, one of the first sort of showcase comedy shows that was in the theaters.
Yeah, and so was ours.
Yeah.
So was ours. And so what we did was we ended up doing a tour with it was actually George Lopez, Paul Rodriguez, and Carlos Mencia. Alex Raimundo and I were just pretty much the openers.
Yeah.
And but I didn't care. We were working. We were doing big venues. We were doing 11,000 seat. We did the Arco Arena. We did.
And there was another. Never anything like that before.
Yeah,
there
was nothing like that. Yeah, it was crazy. So then that's when the Latin Kings came to be kind of the idea. And then I guess what the rumor was is that Carlos Mencia was, I guess said some negative things about Paul on radio. And he got back to him, and then he was out of the tour.
Do you remember? You don't remember anything? What it was?
No, I don't remember. But yeah it was.
Why would he do? Well, who knows why Carlos Mencia does what he does? Anyway.
So, so then the thing was, they decided, okay, we're going to shoot it in El Paso, but it wasn't really. It didn't have a name yet because the name Kings of Comedy belonged to a guy named Walter Latham, who owned the whole franchise.
Yeah.
So Paramount Pictures that had. The Kings of Comedy, they came out to El Paso. Walter Latham came out to El Paso, and we just shot a comedy special, right? That was basically what it was. And we did like a bunch of shows, like 4 shows or whatever.
Where was it in El Paso?
At the Civic Auditorium.
Okay.
So it was
huge.
The theater. Yeah, it was great. It was sold out. Every show was sold out.
Was George Lopez a huge name at this point?
I mean, he was. It was before his TV show, so he was a huge name in the Latin comedy circuit.
Yeah,
but not. He wasn't the George Lopez as he was known now. And then all of us, everybody did a great job. We were there for a whole week. We had so much fun. We did all kinds of promo and stuff. Paramount Pictures loved it. Walter Latham loved it. So they decided it's going to be the Latin Kings of Comedy.
Yeah,
and then it was everything just hit the fan, man. It was beautiful because it was in the movie theaters, like literally. The premiere was in at the Man's Chinese Theater.
Wow!
And it was the first time I watched it sitting in the back with a real audience in front of us laughing. First time I ever seen that as a comedian, audience watching me laughing at me, and I'm in the back. I'm like, oh my god, this is fucking awesome.
Yeah,
and it was great. I remember right when it hit theaters. It was, I would do a show. I was in Albuquerque one time, and after Albuquerque, after my show, I would go to the movie theater and catch the last showing.
Yeah.
And, you know, and I would watch, again, people laughing and everything. And then when they would come out, they would see me and they would autograph. And
that's
when shit started hitting the fan. And I started doing casinos and theaters by myself. And we all started doing real well.
You're doing your own theater tour?
Yeah, yeah.
Oh, wow.
I did my own theater tour, my own casino tour, making shitload of money. Which was beautiful.
Yeah.
And then that was it, because we kind of broke up after that. Everybody kind of did their own thing.
Yeah.
George got his TV show and he didn't need Latin Kings anymore. He just did his thing.
Yeah.
And then Paul, you know, was always on the road. He's still on the road. And Alex was doing his thing. And Alex and I were doing a lot of shows together. But then we were doing our own shows.
Yeah.
So
it was probably one of those things too, like where I think with a lot of different, these minority communities, Hollywood writ large probably didn't realize what a huge fucking market there was for what you guys were doing.
It was the most, I forgot at that point, but it was the highest selling DVD in the history.
Oh, really?
Yeah.
Wow.
And it made gazillions of dollars, man.
So you'd sell those at the casino?
Yeah, I didn't see it. No, but I did. I ended up afterwards, I ended up bootlegging them because I couldn't. At the time, I couldn't. You know, I had obviously a copy, but they were, you know, it was protected.
Yeah.
So it was, you know, so I couldn't. I didn't know how to do it, but of course, I went to the alley here in L.A. and they were selling bootleg versions, and I'm like, I'll buy it, man. And so I bought one because it was easy. Those are easy to copy.
Was it old school where it was a guy with a camera filming the movie?
No, it was nice. It was
okay,
a good.
Okay.
It was a DVD copy, I guess.
Yeah.
So
yeah.
It was a good copy. It wasn't a shitty copy. But I kind of had that done. We did a tour in At the Apollo Theater. We did the Apollo Theater. And we did two sold-out shows. They were great. And right after our show, we walked out, and people were selling our pictures on stage. And I remember Scott Montoya was upset. And I'm like, Scott, this is New York, bro. It's an honor.
Yeah.
That people care.
Yeah.
And he was like, all right.
I want a cut of it.
Yeah. Yeah. Scott was like, yeah, you can't do that. You can't. I'm like, well, dude, don't cock-block them. Let them do their thing.
Yeah. Now, when you watch the set then, and maybe when you watch it now, do you ever look back and go, oh man, I wish I'd done this joke differently. That bit, I could have done this bit. Do you kind of like sort of Monday morning quarterback yourself?
Oh, yeah, yeah. But I think we all do that.
Of course.
We do that with everything.
Yeah, of course.
But I do remember this, though. I remember once we shot it and everything, you know, it still was a few months before it became known, right?
Yeah.
But I knew that I had to step it up a notch as well. And I knew that everyone, especially in the Latin community, comic-wise, going to be like, why him? Why is he in it? Blah, 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 blah. So I knew I had to rise to the occasion, you know, and I had to bring my A game and I had to write more and I had to do better and I had to push myself and push the limits and I did.
And that was probably counterbalancing against the the instant fame and all the women and the parties and the fun times.
Those are fun, dude. They were so much. But it's funny, like we were getting invited, you know, I was getting invited to like premieres to Laura Croft, like with Angelina Jolie.
Yeah.
You know, like she's literally sitting behind me.
Yeah.
You know, and in her own movie. And it was like, this is dope, doing red carpets and all kinds of TV shows and everything. And it was fun. But I also knew enjoy it while it lasts.
Yeah.
I've seen people in our industry where they literally think it's going to last forever, or they're so cocky that they think it's going to last forever. I was actually scared the entire time. I was scared that, okay, this is going to go away. So I never really enjoyed it. It's almost like I had a tuxedo that I rented and go, it's not mine. Like, I'm about to give it back soon.
Yeah.
So I always kind of felt that in that way.
But that's probably good because it prepared yourself for what happens inevitably, which is everything kind of gets
fades
hot
away,
and
right.
gets cold and gets hot.
Yeah. So a big roller coaster, man.
Yeah, yeah. So was there a moment where you felt like the capital from that was kind of going away and you just had to create your own thing? Yeah.
And that's when I decided to produce a comedy special called Latin Palooza.
Okay.
And what I did was I said, okay, I want to do another Latin Kings of Comedy because I knew we were never going to do it. So I said, I'm going to do something big like that.
Yeah.
So during that time, Jamie Foxx had a series called Laugh-A-Palooza.
I remember that, yeah.
Yeah. So what I did was I investigated who distributed it. It was a company called Image Entertainment out of here in California, in the LA area. Well, it was Chatsworth, I think. And so I found out who their guy was.
Yeah.
I set a meeting with him. We went to, I think, California Pizza Kitchen. And I knew how I was going to sell it. I said, I got this project, Latin comedians. Da, da, da. And then, you know, I had my clout from the Latin Kings Comedy, so I got the meeting.
Yeah.
And I go, this is the name, Laugh-A-Palooza, right on the shelf next, I mean, Latin-Palooza, right on the shelf next to Laugh-A-Palooza.
Yeah.
I sold it like right on the shelf. That's yeah. what sold
He's
it.
He goes, great idea.
Okay,
it.
Perfect. And I sold it for $150,000. He gave me, and I got the money, like most of it up front, and I shot the show for that.
Oh, wow.
And,
so you produced the show, found the venue and everything.
Yeah,
and it was shot in?
Alex Theater in Glendale.
Okay, yeah.
And it was sold out show, one show. And I knew, I said, okay, because we're going to do one show, they all have to be heavy hitters.
Yeah.
Because I can't risk having a couple of bad sets because we're going to shoot just one show. So it was myself, Alex Raimundo, because he still had the heat from Latin Kings of Comedy as well. Mike Robles, who just finished, you know, producing Que Locos and all those other shows. Willie Barcena, who's great and was on the Tonight Show a zillion times. And then Darren Carter. And Darren Carter was really great. I didn't know who the next person was going to be.
Is he Latin?
No, well, a little bit. No. No, but what happened was this. What had happened was this. I think like a producer. We were doing a show in Laughlin, and he opened for Alex and I.
Yeah.
And he was doing a lot of Latin material. And
and
the audience was loving it. And I'm like, this would be great. And also would be great because it's called Latin-Palooza. All these Latin people on the title, all these Latin people on the cover. If you have a white guy, people are going to know, oh, okay, it's probably English too. You know?
Yeah,
so,
yeah.
So I asked him, hey, do you want to be on Latin-Palooza? I said, but, you know, definitely do the joke about this and the joke about this. And he did, and he killed it. I think everybody on the show had, to that point, probably the best set they ever had.
Wow.
Because it was an amazing energy.
How many comics was it?
It was me, Alex Raimundo, Willie Barcena, Darren Carter, and Mike Robles.
Okay, yeah.
So it was five of us. And I hosted the show. And I did all the behind-the-scenes stuff. It was the DVD did real great. CAA picked it up. It was on the end caps, the end things of Target. So they,
oh wow,
they did real good. But the reason it didn't get any TV, and the reason it didn't is because that's when people were doing single specials, and the whole group thing wasn't selling that way. But it did great in DVD.
Yeah.
I did a huge. A radio tour, like around the country. They flew me over, you know, and we signed autographs. We did all that stuff. And that show got me a radio, my morning radio show in L.A. Ah. Because I did, there was a new radio station called Latino 96.3. And so I go to do, you know, to promote Latin-Palooza. That was part of the tour. And little did I know, at the time, they were talking to Gabriel Iglesias and they were talking to Carlos Mencia to be part of the morning show. And I didn't know any of this. So I go up there, and I know, you know, as comics, we know how to do radio because we do radio every city we go to. We do a radio interview. So we know how to do morning radio, right? So I killed it. Like, I did it. I did good morning radio. And the general manager was listening. So all of a sudden, I'm driving home, and my manager calls me up, and he says, hey, they want you to come back tomorrow. I'm like, fuck, great. I'll keep promoting Latin-Palooza. That's all I cared about. So when I'm doing it, I realized when I was there, it seemed more like it didn't seem like an interview. It seemed more like I was hanging out with the morning show. But I'm like, it doesn't matter. I was doing my thing. So afterwards, I was there for like 2 hours, and the morning jock that was on, he goes, hey man, they're thinking about asking you to be on the morning show.
Wow.
And I'm like, nah, I'm good. I don't want to do it. So that was it. I said no. I didn't know what kind of money they were talking about. Mm-hmm. Anything. I thought it was shit money.
Radio used to be fucking great money, huh?
Yeah. Oh, yeah. It was. I didn't know that.
Yeah.
And I was making good money at the time in comedy. I was making a lot.
And that waking up early after shows the night before. Yeah.
So I go home, and my manager again called me and said, hey, you know, they're thinking about you doing this morning show. And I'm like, I don't know. But they're like, they like to have you on for a few more days for like maybe about a week every day. I'm like, hey, yes, do that because I want to promote Latin-Palooza. So I kept on promoting Latin-Palooza, doing it. So I didn't know, they would bring me into the office, take me to nice lunch at Houston's.
You didn't know that you're being vetted in basically a long ass audition process.
Yeah. But I knew, but I really didn't think I was going to do it. Yeah. But I'll take all the perks, right? So yeah. I'll take the free lunches and all the shit. So at the time I had a lawyer. So my entertainment lawyer was handling that. So one time Renee Garcia at the time and myself were on the line to Knott's Berry Farm to get in. And the lawyer calls me up. He goes, "Hey man, they're making you an offer." I'm like, "Okay, what is it?" And he tells me the number. And I'm like, "Yeah, that sounds good." And I hung up. I'm like, "Holy shit, I hit the fucking lottery. What the fuck?" And Renee and I jumping around like we're girls. And then all of a sudden, the lawyer calls me up 5 minutes later. He goes, "Oh, actually, it's this amount." And it was even more.
Jesus.
I'm like, "This motherfucker."
Is it a year contract?
It was a 3-year contract.
Yeah.
And it was a certain amount. And then the next year was a certain amount. And then the next year was a certain amount. And then I'm like, "That's the most money I've ever made in my life."
Sure.
And I'm like, "Yeah, I'll do it." Matter of fact, we had my first day on the air. We did it at the Laugh Factory.
Oh,
we had the morning show at the Laugh Factory. They had a limousine pick me up at my house. And man, that radio station had good money, man. They treated me good.
Yeah.
Anytime I needed to fly somewhere or go, they would. It was great.
That's insane.
Yeah, I had an expense account. It was ridiculous, dude. I would drink at a club somewhere in like Century City, and I'll just go to the hotel and put on my expense account. They were fine with it.
Yeah,
they didn't
yeah.
care, and it was fun. And the only one of the negative things though was because I was on the radio, and dude, they did a. It was like I think it was $3 million billboard campaign. My face was everywhere. It was on buses.
Wow.
It was on the trains. It was at the train station.
I mean, the face of billboard like in Hollywood is a big deal.
Well, check this out. I'll backtrack a little bit. Right before that, I was trying to get a PA agent, and I couldn't get a PA agent. I was getting a lot of work, but I didn't have a PA agent and a public appearance agent. And I was calling everybody. Nobody was like, I'm like, "All right, cool." But I was getting a lot of work, so it wasn't a lot of pressure. But the second those billboards came up, everyone and their mother called me. People I didn't know, managers, and you know what I did? Because I always knew, I go, everybody loves when the spotlight's on. And I ended up signing with Gersh, but even when I knew I was signing with Gersh, I took lunch with everybody.
Yeah.
And they took me to Dantana's, they took me here, they took me there. That's when, Jamie took me to the Palms, and I'm having lunch with everybody, and I'm like, hey, you weren't calling me before, but now you're calling me. I'll take it. Let's do it. So, So anyway, that happened with that, but it was great, man. I had a morning show. One of the negative things was I was on the radio and it was a huge thing. Everybody and their mother who had a room called me up, asked me to do it. And I didn't want to be the asshole to say no
because
I was on the radio. So I was saying yes to everybody. And, you know, normally, I was waking up at 4 in the morning.
Jesus.
And I was doing these gigs at 12 at night. I would literally pull over sometimes in the middle of the night driving home because I was falling asleep.
Yeah.
One time I had in my Mercedes, I almost hit this thing on the medium, and I was like, woke me up, and I pulled over. I fell asleep, and it was just, so I ended up getting an apartment right next to the radio station. So I had a house, then I had an apartment.
Baller status. And then,
yeah, I bought my mama house. It was
that's,
good.
That's the fucking
it thing. Was good when it would last it. But yeah, so it was fun, man. It was fun. But yeah, I didn't want to say no to people because I didn't want to be a dick.
So after 3 years, was it? Did you have an opportunity to renew, or was it an option that you were thinking?
What happened was. It was during that recession, man.
2008.
Yeah, 2007, 2008, 2008, and. A lot of people don't know this, but the biggest sponsors for radio stations are car dealerships. Like Toyota gave me a free lease.
Yeah.
It's a convertible, brand new car, just to drive it for free. And they were my sponsor. And that's when they were going bankrupt. Remember, they had to be bailed out and everything. So they bought radio all over the country. Like Big Boy was doing the morning show, his morning show. He got a big pay cut. He didn't get fired. He got a big pay cut. I don't know if you remember this. In L.A., there was a guy named Cucuy in the Mañana. It was a Spanish. He was actually the number one show in L.A. It was a Spanish show called In the Cucuy. And the same owners that owned his show owned ours. And that guy was getting paid like $2 million a year. And they fired him. And he was number one in L.A., number one.
Wow.
And that's – so when he got fired, I told my team, I'm like, I'm next.
Yeah.
And they go, no, we're because we tied power.
Yeah.
So we went all the way from nothing, and in the 2 years I was there, we went all the way up to number four with power at the time.
Yeah.
And I'm like, they go, no. I'm like, dude, it's like, oh, they fired Kukui.
Yeah.
He's number one. We're number four. So you know, shortly after that, the general manager brought me to the office, and they fired a lot of people before me.
Yeah.
And he goes, hey, man, we're going to have to let you go. I'm like, fuck. I go, how about if you give me half? Like, I don't think it was So they gave me a big severance pay, which was great.
Yeah.
That helped a lot. But I was in shock, man. I was like going. And then, and because I wasn't doing a lot of road gigs, because it was just hard for me to go on the road working this much. Then it was like out of sight, out of mind again. And I'm like, oh, now I got to get back on the road. And it's like, oh. And I remember I was panicking, like internally I was panicking. And that's when I met Russell Peters, and we were talking, and he goes, hey, man, open for me in Houston. And I went, well, yeah, right. And I ended up working with him in Australia and Asia, and we went all these other places.
And a lot of people know this in the comedy world, but like Russell Peters is one of the few headliners that really pays well.
Yes.
He pays.
And treats well.
And treats well. Like a lot of headliners bring their openers like, hey, I can get anybody, so here's $250 for a theater show.
Right, right.
And Russell, I opened for him a couple times, but I remember it was at Hard Rock in Fort Lauderdale, and it was like, I said, I'll fly you out, give you $1,500. Is that okay? I'm sorry, I can't do more. I was like, are you fucking kidding me? Yeah.
Yeah, of course.
Yeah.
Dude, I'm not going to mention name. He was on Saturday Night Live, and I was doing a show in Vegas. He's doing the theater next to it the next day, and he's like, he goes, he asked for, can I do a guest spot? I'm like, yeah, dude, duh, of course, right? Do the guest spot. So he goes, hey, man, I'm doing a show tomorrow. You want to open for me? I'm like, yeah, man, no problem, you know? So I stayed an extra day, and didn't offer me a penny. Now, still, not a penny, not one penny. Now, I still would have done it. I didn't care.
Yeah.
I didn't ask, hey, how much, nothing, I did it. But in my mind,
did he do too well and he was pissed?
I did really well.
Yeah.
But I don't think that's the reason. I just think he probably thought, he should be honored to be opening for me kind of thing.
Yeah, yeah.
And I don't know if that's what he thought. I'm just assuming. But yeah, I thought that was odd. That was a little strange.
Have you seen him since then?
Yeah.
You ever go, hey, you know what?
Yeah, I was actually, okay, so check this out. So then he tells me, he's like, hey, man, I'm doing a sitcom. He goes, I would love for you to be in it. And so we exchanged phone numbers. I'm like, dude, I got this guy's number. It's great, right? And so like 2 months later, it's like Sunday, I get called up. I get a call from him. So I answer. I'm in the supermarket. I'm like, hey, brother, what's up? He goes, hey, can you come to Orlando? And this was Sunday. He goes, Tuesday. We're shooting Tuesday. So that means I would have had to leave the next day. So I had to buy my own ticket to Orlando, Florida, like overnight, like the next day, 24 hours. And I'm like, sure, I'll do it. And I did. It was an expensive ass ticket, but I'm like, you know, it's an opportunity. I don't, got to do what you got to do. And so I'm flying there, and I'm looking at the script they sent me, and it wasn't any characters that he said. He said something, I'm like a day laborer or a worker or something. I'm like, all right, well. But the script they sent me had this gay character that was hilarious, and so then when I got to Florida, I got the new one, and it was literally one line. All I had was one line. I'm like, oh shit, all right. So I get to set the next day, and he's really cool, and he's like, hey man, you want me to make you espresso? Like we're shooting on location at this house, and I'm like, yeah, dude. And they're putting me in my little day laborer uniform, and And then I'm going, hey, who's playing that one character, that Mauricio character? And he's like, oh, we haven't booked that yet. So I did something similar on a Roseanne show. And so I found it on YouTube, and I showed him. And he's like, oh, man, I wish I would have seen this. So he goes, come over here. Let me come. His wife was on the show, but his wife is also executive producer. So he didn't even introduce me to his wife. We walked up to his wife. He showed her the video, and she goes, oh, my God. That's Mauricio. So he just turns around and he goes, all right, you're fired today. You come back next week. So I'm like, all right, thanks. So they gave it to, they put somebody else in that part. And then I spoke to the producer, and I'm like, hey, you guys going to fly me in next week?
Yeah.
He goes, Jesus. Yeah, we're going to fly you. Don't worry about it. I'm like, oh, thank God. All right. So they paid me regular, you know, and they.
This is the pilot episode?
No, this was it wasn't a pilot episode. This
it was on the series. Yeah,
yeah, already. It was on the series. Okay. Yeah.
How long did you do that for?
I just one show. I just did one show.
Yeah.
But it was a main part. Major part. Yeah. And it was great, man. It was great. It was fun. You know. Yeah. And it was fun.
Did you like the sitcom world? Because a lot of some comics love it, and some comics are like, ugh.
I love it in the sense that I know what it does.
Yeah.
You know what I mean? I know what it does for us. You know, I actually shot my own pilot. I was, I was going through a real down part in my career and my life. I was poor, and this was not too long ago. And I was living literally in the guest house of George Gray, who's the announcer on The Price is Right. Mm-hmm. He's a really good friend of mine. And, you know, he took pity on me. And he's like, hey, just live here. So I lived in his house for like 2 years for
free. You
were
like the Cato Kalin.
Yeah, I was his kid. That's why I used to tell him I'm your Cato. I'm like, dude, but if you kill anybody, I ain't saying shit. Don't worry about it. I know who's feeding me, man. So I was really depressed. Then I was watching one of the shows I love to watch was Louis C.K. show, right?
Yeah.
And I was watching an interview with Louis, and Louis was talking about how he was speaking to the people, I guess, at FX or whoever it was, and they gave him like $200,000 to shoot his own show. And now he writes, produces, directs, edits, does
craft
all
service.
That. Yeah, I mean, he does everything, right? So, and I remember thinking to myself, oh man, I wish I could do that. Then I go, wait a second, I can. And then I have all this equipment. I'm like, you know what, fuck it.
Yeah.
And so in 2 weeks, I wrote a script, a pilot script for me. And it kind of was basically loosely based on what was happening in my life back then. Somebody who was doing really, really well and then now wasn't.
Yeah.
But yet had to also keep the appearances. Because people don't know that. Once people see you as up, they think that's always that way. They don't understand you have bad days. They don't understand you have bad years, you know. They just don't get it. And I get it. I don't, you know, I went from a Mercedes to a Prius, you know what I mean? So I get it, right? So, I put all that in the show. And then I borrowed $4,000 from somebody who hired me to direct the film, and they couldn't produce the film. They just didn't have the right money for it and everything. But we were buddies, and I'm like, hey, would you like to be executive producer in this project? Loan me $4,000. I'm going to shoot it. Now, I budgeted $4,000, but I didn't know how I was going to do it for $4,000. But I kind of knew and I kind of did it. I'm like, oh, I'm going to just shoot it around here. And I did it. And the pilot looks fucking amazing. And I was really impressed with my. Russell Peters was in it. He let me shoot in his house.
Wow!
I shot George Gray's house with George Gray. George Gray played himself. Russell played himself.
It's kind of like a Curb Your Enthusiasm type of style.
Yeah, yeah. It was single camera style. I was more of the straight man. Everybody else around me was like George's character was really funny. He was himself, except he was into old women. That's why he was on The Price is Right. So, like, so the scene that he's in the pool wearing a thong, and he's like, all these old chicks are around him. It's really funny. And George is great. I love George to death. And so anyway, it's a really well done pilot, and it did not look like it was 4,000. It looked a lot bigger.
Yeah.
So I sent it to a producer friend that I know just to have to see what he thought. And he looked at it, and he called me, and he goes, hey, let's just come into my office, have a little meeting. I'm like, all right, cool, cool. And what was your budget, like $200,000 on this? I'm like, are you fucking kidding me, bro? I did this for $4,000. He goes, what? I go, yeah, I did this for, he goes, that's how you're going to sell this, bro. And he goes, okay, I'm producing this game show. Do you want to write for it? I'm like, yeah. So even though I did it to get me back on the swing of things and take me out of poverty.
Yeah.
Right. It did it not the way I wanted it. Like I wanted to sell it and I didn't get to pitch it to anybody. I got a job right away. And I'm like, okay, it worked. So it's kind of like what happened with the radio station. I did Lampalooza to do something else. It didn't accomplish what I wanted. It accomplished a lot, but it didn't accomplish what I wanted. But it got me this radio show, which was amazing.
Yeah.
It's called Man of a Funny Age. The show I did. And it didn't get me that to be aired anywhere, even though I still have it and I can still push it. But it got me another show on television. So
yeah.
It's you know, it's funny how I just think in this business, in any, I think show business in general, it's like maybe in life really is like momentum brings momentum.
Yeah, for sure. Work begets work.
Yeah, yeah. And I think that's just the way it is. And that's one of the reasons I'm doing all the things like, you know, yeah, we did together.
Well, that's what we're talking about too. So like, when was your transition? Because I always think it's a good idea. If you're a creative person, I think sometimes a lot of creatives, like, they think I got to be in front of the camera all the time.
Right.
Think that's the only way they're going to, like, you know, get their nut, scratch that mm-hmm. itch. And if you're creative in front of the camera, you can be creative behind the camera. And a lot of times the thing is a lot more rewarding.
Right.
But people, for some reason, they don't see that because they get caught up in the idea of the fame and whatever. But what was your transition into being a director?
Well, to be honest, that actually happened before comedy.
Yeah.
And it didn't really take place until after comedy, but it took – when I was a little kid, the way it first started is in fifth grade, I had this teacher named Morris Charnow. That was his name. And what he did was one day he put on the Super 8 film
mm-hmm.
that he did with the class the year before, which was like a parody of Batman. And Super 8 didn't have – there was no sound. You know, it was all shitty. And I remember, you know, he did it with his class. And I remember watching this little film. My mouth like dropped. And all I could think was, I want to do that.
Yeah.
But it wasn't, I want to be in front of the camera. Like, I didn't want to play Batman. I wanted to make that film.
Yeah.
I wanted, that's all I knew. It was like, I want to do that. So, like, in seventh grade, I bought a projector, a Super 8 camera, and a screen from my shop teacher for $50. And it was all stolen. It was all Board of Education on it. But I didn't know. I bought it from my shop teacher for $50. And I made a little King Kong parody movie, right? And I loved it. And I wasn't in it. It was, I got, you know, my families and friends to be in it. And I just was the director. I didn't know that's what it was called. I didn't know I wanted to be a director. I just knew I wanted to make a movie, right?
Yeah.
So then I just thought, yeah, you know, when I get older, I'm going to make movies. I'm going to do all this. And, you know, I want to do that and stuff. But then I got really heavy in boxing, and I just focused on boxing. Forgot about movies, and that was it.
So your dream was to be a professional boxer for a while.
Yeah. That was my one and only dream. And then, but I always loved filmmaking and stuff. I loved movies. I loved all that. Then I got into comedy. So I got into comedy. I was living in Tucson, Arizona at the time. Then I like about a year into it, I decided to move to L.A. So I moved to L.A. I bought a laptop with a gig that I had. I'm like, oh, I'm going to buy this. And I wrote it. I'm going to write a script to put myself in it. I'm going to write the script, and I'm going to be the star of the script. I'm going to make this movie and, you know, help my comedy career, right? But as I'm writing this film, I'm realizing I'm not this character.
Mm.
I go, I'm not him. Like, I don't want to play him. And then I decided I'm just going to direct it. So I took myself, I gave myself a cameo, a little cameo, but I did. And then I actually made the movie. It was horrible. It's called El Matador. You can see it for free on YouTube. Yeah, it's a feature. And it was horrible and great at the same time. if you're drunk, if you're high, watch it and you will love it. Paul Rodriguez is in it. Alex Ramono is in it. Emilio Rivera from Sons of Anarchy is in it. Gabriel Iglesias is in it. That was the first movie he ever did was in that. He was in that. Felipe Esparza is in it. Martin Moreno. A whole bunch of cats, right? Benny Mena. Like everyone I knew was in the movie. And I sold it for like double what I made it for. And then it's funny. When I was doing the credits, I'm like, oh, wait, I was also the producer.
Yeah.
I never would have been. A producer sounds boring. I don't want to be a producer, right? But I'm like, oh, wait, I'm a producer too. Okay. So now I know what a producer. I wrote it, directed, and produced it, right? So I'm like, okay, cool. So I did that. And then, you know, and then I just really was focused on the comedy. So I was only just doing my comedy. But then when I was doing the radio show, I ended up meeting this girl group, and I did their music video. And I remember thinking I really want to direct. And then I started pushing myself more and more, buying my own equipment and doing stuff. And then just doing it more and more seriously. So I did a few music videos. I did a couple of shorts. And then my thing is this. I don't shoot as much as other people or as consistently as other people. So I always make sure everything I do is better and better every time by a big amount. And my goal is always I want it to look a certain way. And so, I just ended up hooking up with good people. I ended up one time, another thing was when a comedian tells people he wants to be a director, they expect them all to do just comedies, and they don't take them serious.
Yeah.
So when I decided I want to be taken serious, I decided I'm going to do a horror film. I'm going to do something, and not just coming out, popping out of the bushes kind of bullshit. I'm going to make something that's going to make people drop their jaw and go, "What the fuck is this?"
Yeah.
So I decided to make this film called The Missing. And it was black and white except the blood. The only thing in color was blood.
Yeah.
I like that idea, right? I'm like, okay, I want to do that. And then it's kind of like it's a torture film. It's bloody, it's gutty, and it's like – and remember Willie Barsena, I showed him the film before it was actually completed. And he looked at it, and he just looked at me and goes, "Man, you must have been in a dark place when you made this." And I'm like, "No." It was funny. I go, "I just wanted to do the opposite of comedy."
Yeah.
That was one I wanted to do. And that actually, I won a directing award in a film festival. I won Best Screenplay Award.
Wow.
I was nominated for a whole bunch of freaking awards on that. Acting, I didn't know who was going to play the lead. I knew what I kind of wanted, but I didn't know what I wanted. I just knew I wanted somebody different.
Yeah.
And I was doing a show one time over at John Lovitz, and there was, a comic named Ron Swallow?
Yeah.
Ron's a great guy. And so I'm watching him. He's just awkward. Now he looks all handsome and everything, but when I met him, he's this weird, goofy, awkward dude. And I'm looking at him going, "Yeah, I could see that." So I go, "Hey, man, do you act?" He goes, "Yeah, I can act." I'm like, "No, I could tell he can't act already." So then... he goes, "Yeah, I did a sketch for my friend," or something like that. Right? So I'm like, "Look, come do an audition. I'm doing this horror movie." So he did this audition, and he was fucking horrible. And I remember being so disappointed in my mind, going, "Oh, this guy's horrible." Then I go, "Wait a second." And then I had him improv some stuff, and I'm like, "This can work."
Yeah.
And I didn't say anything. I let him go, "Thank you, man." He went home, and I thought about it for a couple of days. And I go, "This can work," because he looks so fucking awkward in front of the camera that he's more believable.
Yeah.
He's not acting like he's a serial killer, right?
Sure.
So I gave him the part. He goes, "Man, I thought I did bad." I go, "Oh, no, you did. You were fucking horrible, bro." He goes, "Well," I go, "yeah, but it's going to work. Trust me."
Yeah.
And it did. He came across perfect.
Yeah.
I had to work with him more because he wasn't a real trained actor, but he naturally was uncomfortable, and it looked great. And then I put my girlfriend's 92-year-old grandmother in it to make it even more weird. It was a good little 14-minute movie, and it did real well for me.
Do you get to sell it?
I didn't sell it. I got other work from it, and I did stuff. But it's hard to make money from a short film.
Yeah, for sure.
But it's easier to finance a short film.
Yeah.
You know, and on that one, no one got paid. No crew, nobody. And it was shot at one location, and all I did was I paid for props and blood and all that kind of stuff. And, and food, obviously. But it was fun, man. It taught me a lot, because on that show, I did everything. I edited it. I cut it. I shot it. I lit it. I designed the special effects. I did all of that.
Yeah.
And I wanted to do that. And when I did my pilot, that's one thing too. I said, "I'm going to sell it because I want people to go, this is the poor man's Louis C.K. Every comic has an idea, right?
Yeah,
every actor has an idea. But I wanted to show, look, I can write, produce. Now, they don't have to hire me for that. They could get somebody. I don't care. But I want them to know that I'm capable of doing it.
Yeah.
So that's why I wrote it, directed and produced it. And even though I hate editing, I'm a good editor. I'm just very slow.
Yeah.
Because I don't edit a lot. I don't like it. It's pissing me off when I edit. But I know how to edit because it's my vision, so it's easy for me to edit in that sense. So that's how that happened.
Yeah, and so you're doing shorts. How many features have you done?
I've only done one feature, believe it or not. But I've done a handful of shorts, a handful of music videos, a bunch of little sketches, and I've worked on other people's projects and stuff.
So when did the idea, because this is leading to this, me and Joey did a short together.
Yes, we did.
Joey wrote and directed, produced. And when did this idea...
And you're the co-producer, man.
I'm the co-producer,
yes, yeah. That's right.
Here's the money. Where did this idea come from? Because it's an interesting concept. I mean, I guess you can tell that.
Yeah, yeah.
Concept.
What had happened was...
What happened was...
It came from it came about for two different ways. The original concept of it came about. There was a time in my life where it was really dark, bro, where I wasn't planning to commit suicide, but I was thinking it.
Yeah.
And I remember having life insurance. And I remember thinking, well, if I kill myself, my family can't get my life insurance. I remember thinking that.
Yeah.
And then I was getting gas, like in Compton or somewhere. And I remember watching some drug dealers or some thugs or some whatever, gang members, right? And I remember thinking, I bet you if I went up to them and insulted them or hit them or did something, they would kill me.
Yeah.
But then I thought, wait, what if they don't have a gun? Then I started thinking of all this stuff, and I'm like, fuck, it's not going to work. Yeah. And then, you know, boom, my gas finished. I'm like, all right, fuck it. There goes that plan, right? So I didn't think about it, but I thought of the concept of doing it, right? So that stayed in my mind. I never thought about writing a movie like that or script like that or anything. Then I wrote a script called Philly Delight about a transgender drag queen that wanted to commit suicide. It's weird. I'm doing a bunch of suicide shit. And it was right before COVID. And I was raising money, doing some GoFunding, because I was going to need around 10 grand for this one. It was a lot of moving parts. But then when the pandemic started and we were isolated, we couldn't do anything, that was out the picture. Because a lot of locations, a lot of actors, I just couldn't have done it. So I'm thinking, what can I do with two people in one place? And then I don't know how, but I remembered that thing. I'm like, okay, how about a guy who's wants to commit suicide because he's, you know, and I'm thinking about this whole concept. But he has to be killed, because if he doesn't get killed, or if it's killed, it's doubled. The money's doubled. And then there was, you know, and I remember seeing other things, like other projects like that. So then I'm like, okay, I started thinking about it, and I wrote it. I'm like, okay, I can do this. So I wrote it really quick, like in a week. And I gave it a few people. I tweaked it. I did this, that. And then I called my buddy. I'm like, but I knew logistically, I'm like, okay, if I'm going to guerrilla it in Nally, it could be difficult. It's going to be hard. It's going to be a lot of makeup involved. I need a place, little headquarters, so we can do the makeup. And so I called my friend. Before that, I did a short called The Lesson with three people in a warehouse. So I called my friend who loaned me that location, Gilbert, who's a great guy. I love him to death, Gilbert Della Torre. And I go, listen, he was working at a new place. I go, is there an alley by your job or anything? He goes, no, but, you know, maybe you could shoot it here. I'm like, I go, okay, let me Google Earth it. So I Google Earth it. I was looking for an alley around his job. And then I didn't see an alley, but I saw there was some space in between these two buildings. So I'm like, that's interesting. And I called him up. Well, what's in there? He goes, oh, we just keep park our trucks there. I'm like, can I take a look at it? So I went over there and looked at it. And I'm like, yeah, fuck, this could work. I could dress it up.
Yeah.
You know, I just somehow spray paint it without getting spray. I go buy some spray paint. I could erase. I'm thinking all that. I go, put garbage, make it look like an alley. So I brought my DP, Steven, over there. We looked at it, and we talked about it. He goes, all right, we can put a light over here. We can put and I had electricity because that room next to us, we had that garage type thing. I'm like, there's a bathroom. You know, we can have makeup there. We can do all that. We have the power. I'm like, this is it.
Yeah.
So that's when it was. So I prepared for it, and, you know, we did it. And then because it was COVID, because it was really hard doing the auditions. Now, when I wrote this, I really wanted the white character to be really tiny and small.
Yeah.
And I wanted the black character to be very big.
Yeah.
Matter of fact, one of the people I was thinking about for the part in the beginning was Claude Stewart. You know Claude Stewart.
Okay, right? Yeah.
He's a real tiny guy.
Yeah.
He's weighs as much as my dick. Like, he's really little. And, but I wasn't sure how his acting was. And, but I had him in mind because I like that size.
Yeah.
And I love him. He's a great guy, too. And then I was, you know, I was talking to Craig Robinson to play the other part. He was really considering it, and he couldn't do it. And then I was auditioning people, and all the auditions were on, you know, self-tape, and I hate those. I'd rather just
be in the room, yeah.
Be in the room, feel. So I wasn't finding anything. And then you auditioned, and I wasn't really sure about you. Only I knew you were a great actor. I just think you were too big for the too manly looking for the part.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Right. No, because otherwise then I would have had to get a bigger actor. Mm-hmm. You know what I mean? Even bigger. So, because originally the character was going to be thrown around and like a rag, you know. But your audition was fucking great. And I was like, oh fuck, man, Bill's really doing great, man. Because before I got your audition, I got Claude's, and Claude's was fucking great. I'm like, he came to my house and he auditioned my house, and he way better than I thought.
Yeah.
And like I was real smart. I did it once and I will never do it again. But I was almost going to give him the part there at the house. But I'm like, because I still knew yours was coming, and I think a couple other people. And then I saw yours and I was like, oh fuck, he's so fucking good, man. I just wish he was so big. And then I thought, okay, I'm probably going to work harder with Claude than with Bill, because Bill is a lot better actor. And I go, I think Bill, you can work with Bill. And your audition was great. So then I'm like, all right, cool. And then you turn me on to Eric, right? And then I'm like, I didn't think about Eric at all. Never in a million years I would have even asked him to do it, because I didn't even think he could act. And then you showed me that one thing with the N-word, right? And I'm like, okay, that's funny. It was good. And I'm like, all right, let's see what he's got. And he fucking did great, man. The audition was great. And more importantly, I love that he wanted it.
Yeah.
Because that's what I look for. Like, even if I take someone on the road, or I want them to want it.
Yeah.
Because then I know they're going to give it 100%, right? And then, you know, then you guys came over to the house. I want to see the chemistry between both of you, and it was fine. And again, I could see that he was really wanting. He was asking a lot of questions. Hey, man, whatever you need, ba 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 da da da. And you know, I'm not saying this because you're here. Like, I always tell people, you're a pro, man. You're a fucking pro. You know, and that means a lot for a director or a producer, anybody doing a film. And so then it was you guys. And, yeah, you know, we did a couple of rehearsals. We did this. And I'm like, all right, well, let's see what we got.
You know, it's funny about that, because it goes back to Scott Montoya. So, because he was the producer on the show where we did the N-word video.
Oh, really? That's hilarious.
And for people who don't know, so what happened was. So Pookie Wigington, Chocolate Sundays, shout out to Pookie and Chocolate Sundays. He had a show called the Chocolate Sunday Variety Show on Showtime.
Oh, okay.
And we shot like the pilot episode. And that was the first sketch in the episode.
Oh, okay.
This N-word sketch. And it was the only thing I was in.
Right.
Like, I didn't get to do stand-up in the special. I was like, oh, fuck, this sucks.
Right.
I was like the low man on the totem pole. And it went well, but, you know, it was fine. And the special came out, didn't generate any buzz. I talked to Pookie. He goes, yeah, man, Showtime might pick it up. There might be more. And just nothing.
Mm-hmm.
And then, like, 2 years after that, I got a phone call from Samson one day. I was in New York doing a Broadway show. And Samson Kirkman called me. He goes, are you checking out what's happening on Facebook right now? I go, no. And I went, I looked. This black DJ in Berlin.
Oh, wow.
He ripped it. He ripped that scene from the special himself. And he put the banner, how a white man says the N-word.
Yeah, yeah, yeah.
He said the full word.
Right.
He didn't say that word because he's a black dude. And he just posted on Facebook. And that first day when I looked at it, it had gotten 3 million views.
Holy shit, man. That's awesome.
Just several hours.
Uh-huh.
And I'm going, he's like, you got to do something about this. Like, I don't know what the fuck. What do you mean? What am I going to do? So, and I thought maybe it was going to die down, but it kept building. And then the next day, it was 8 million views.
Wow.
And then it was 10. And I was like, what the fuck to do? So it created this weird sort of fury with Scott Montoya, with Chocolate Sunday, with Laugh Factory, because all of a sudden they realized, well, we can actually monetize it. So I actually told Pookie, I said, look, man, like, you can catch the tail end of this lightning just by posting the clip on YouTube.
Right.
So he posted on the Chocolate Sunday site, and I told Jamie the same thing, and he posted on the Laugh Factory site. And those views started, like, racking up. I think right now at the Laugh Factory site, it's like 60 million or something.
Holy shit, that's awesome, man.
But then I tried to post it on my Facebook, and I couldn't because it was watermarked.
Right.
So I kept going, Scott, can I go, I'm not making, I go, first of all, no one knows my name in this.
Scott's like that.
It's got 100 million views on, it was on WorldStar and all this
other
shit. I go, I'm not getting any name. My name isn't even fucking mentioned. Can I just rip it? He's like, quit bugging me, man. Why? I go, what the fuck? Then I found out that he actually was trying to sue Jamie Masada.
Oh, really?
About the money for it.
Uh-huh.
And they worked out some deal. So now they're both make, I don't know how much money you get from 60 million views on YouTube.
I'm sure it's more than nothing.
More than anything I've got, because I haven't seen a dime from it. But what's funny about that is so I wrote that bit, Pookie just said, here's the concept. You're a white guy. You can't say the N-word, so you have your black guy say it for you.
Right.
So write the sketch. And so they kept rotating different black actors in. And they would always go for the heavy, the big guy, right in the middle, who's just like, and they would get these like huge, big black guys, whatever. And, you know, no one knew what the fuck was going on. So people were dropping out and like kept rotating actors. And I remember when Eric came on, I was like, oh, same thing. Oh, he's not big enough. He's not really scary enough to me or whatever. And then he did it. And I remember thinking, like, there's something about this guy that's fucking terrifying.
Right.
That's like legit terrifying. Like he's killed a human being before. You know what I mean? There are people they're small, whatever, but like you've murdered before, haven't you? And I'm not saying he has. But and I remember, so when you were looking for someone for this, same thing, you want to pick, I was like, man, I don't know, there's something about Eric. And I had Eric do my podcast. You know, he was like, he was basically running a cartel. I don't know if you know that. And he had like a real tragedy with his child when he was running a cartel. His 2-year-old drowned in a pool.
Talking horrible, man.
So he, and he changed his life around. He's married, 4 kids, great wife, happy, great fucking guy. But he has that, you know. And this story that you wrote connects to this stuff.
Right.
So I just felt like, even if he's not a seasoned actor yet, talking about this stuff, talking about your son telling you that you're a great dad, knowing that you're doing some bullshit,
right,
must be such a weird fucking feeling that you, even if you're not even, it's there in the background, it's churning in your brain, even when you're saying the lines. And and I think, like we never talked, I don't know if you talked about it during the shoot or whatever, but when I watch the film now and that monologue where he talks about his son. And it was pretty dramatic.
Right.
It's semi kind of big performance, but like underneath it is this fucking like real authenticity. I every time I see it, that makes me emotional.
Yeah, cutting that scene, there were people that were like, "It's too melodramatic. Bring it down." There's, you know, he's in the, and I was watching. I'm like, I'm like, it's, I love it. Like, I fucking, because I believe it. Like,
yeah.
When, like, when, you know, I'm watching him, and there's like, there's a pause, too. Like, there was, I think I was telling, I told him one time when I was talking to him the other day, I go, there's this little pause where he talks about his son, he stops, and he looks around, does this. And then the editor wanted to cut that. He goes, let's make a time. I'm like, no. That is beautiful. I go, he's feeling it.
Yeah.
I go, I want to feel it with him. I want to go on this ride with him.
Yeah.
And so I'm like, it stays. The only thing I think I cut out when he says congratulations, when your character, when you tell him that you're having a baby.
Yeah.
And he says, well, congratulations. I cut that out because I wanted him to still be a little harder.
Yeah, for sure.
So, but in that little section, I think that's all I cut. And, And it proved, you know, one of the festivals that we're in, he ended up winning Best Actor.
Yeah.
And I told him, I go, dude, it was because of that. That dialogue
speech,
about your kid, man.
That's
what
sure,
you won
speech.
Best Actor.
Yeah.
I believed it. I fucking believed it.
Yeah. It's funny because a lot of times you'll get notes for auditions as an actor where they'll say, like, we want, like, Barb and Star goes to Vista Del Mar.
Right.
But we want it real. Like, don't go over the top. That's the most over the fucking top goof-ass movie in the world. So I'm going, so what they mean when they tell actors don't go over the top is don't be bad and over the top.
Right.
They want you over the top. We're here to watch drama. They want, but if it's bad, it's awful.
But one of the things that during shooting that I kept on trying to bring him down on was his reaction to his hand. Because in the script, he breaks his hand. And he was just doing, I'm like, in my mind, I'm going, he looks more hurt than Bill's character, man. So I'm like, just bring it down. And then I'm thinking, well, I'll just fix it in editing. Cause I, like, we had, you know, we were on the time that's grand. So I'm thinking 1,000 different things, right? In my mind. So when we get into post, it's like, I'm rethinking the movie because I'm watching it. I'm like, how am I going to cut around that? You know, how can I cut with him doing this hand thing? But I want to, I liked it in the beginning when he first hits you, he looks at his hand, he does that, he's doing that. And I'd rather have that than him forget about it at all. Then people are like, well, I didn't know his hand was broken.
Yeah.
Like, trust me, you know his hand is broken on this, right? So, and he even says it because it's in the lines. But But then I'm thinking, no, you know what? I'm watching this character develop in my own as we're doing it, because I'm going, he never probably hit anybody.
Yeah.
Because the guy, he went to college, he's doing the, and he fucking hit somebody, his hand's broken, it's like, what, you know, you never, your character was never hit, his character never probably never hit nobody. So, yeah, I guess if you do break your hand, and I was a professional boxer, which I've broken my hand a couple of times, fucking that shit hurts, man.
Yeah.
And I'm thinking, okay, because one of the reasons why the character originally slumps next to you is because he was supposed to be really big.
Yeah.
It's character and kind of just out of breath.
Yeah, yeah.
And he, you know, kind of, all right, I'm fucking done beating this guy. Let me lay down here or sit down here and just take a break. But he doesn't look like that. So by him sitting down because, fuck, I broke my hand, I'm like, okay, I could believe that.
Yeah.
So it was kind of writing itself. So I actually used his not overacting, but his overdoing the hand thing, in my mind anyway, is a rewrite.
Yeah.
So it worked for me.
Yeah, yeah.
And, it works fine, I think.
Yeah, and it's doing the festival circuit. It's gotten to, like, 4 or 5 right now?
No, it's around 6 or 7. I think we got in one more yesterday or today.
Oh, okay. That's cool.
Yeah, yeah.
And I've never really had a short film do the festival market before. Yeah. I don't know. I mean, are festivals, are they live now? Can you go and travel?
Some are live, some aren't. Some are hybrid. Like the Venice Film Festival wasn't live. But the festival, because you really don't make a lot of money in short films, but you can. But you can get things. I mean, you know, short films can be nominated for Emmys. Grammys.
Oscars. Yeah.
Oscars, I'm sorry. And if you nominate for an Oscar, your ticket, you just wrote your ticket. You know, so, and hopefully it'll be back when the, you know, agents will be calling me again. So I'm inspired to do that. I want people to see it because I think it's a great project. I think everyone did wonderful in it. And I think it has a good message, you know?
Yeah.
And I think there was people told me they got a lot of messages from it. I'm like, good.
Yeah.
Good. I like it. And if it pops for you, it pops for you. It's awesome.
Yeah.
You know? And I love the fact that the two lead actors in it are comedians. And, you know, the guy who wrote it, directed, and produced is a comedian.
Yeah.
And this is such a dramatic piece. And I'm like, I fucking love that. I love that. Because I've always felt comics are some of the best dramatic actors. Or be.
Yeah, for sure.
I mean, depends. But it's a... But you can, because it's... Doing comedy, I think, is hard. Like, when I audition for comedy, I hate it.
I hate it.
Because it's like, I've got to do their timing. It's
Yeah, you got to be the character funny.
Yeah, yeah. And it's I don't want to actually do that. I can be funny naturally, but I don't want to be funny like this Bob character.
Yeah, yeah.
I'll be funny like me. But if it's a dramatic character, I can be dramatic because I'm dramatic.
Yeah.
You know, if you listen to me and my girlfriend, I'm dramatic. We fight all the time, and it's dramatic, but it's... So anyway, so I've always believed that. So I love the fact that, matter of fact, like one of the trivia thing on IMDb for Beautiful Violence is the name of the film, by the way, everybody, is the trivia question. You know, all the films have, it's that, not trivia, but it's the film was made by three comedians, and even though it's a dramatic piece. So so I thought that was a cool little,
yeah, yeah, yeah.
Little,
you know,
trivia.
It's funny too, because it's also just a weird kind of full circle story that I do this N-word video with Eric Blake.
I know, it's weird.
He says the N-word for me.
Right.
And then
you
I call him the N-word.
you get to say it.
And what's interesting about that, too, is I was talking to a couple people. I mean, I was never in a place where I was like, should I do it?
Right.
Because you have qualified immunity as an actor.
Yes.
No absolutely. Matter what you fucking do.
Right.
You could be, you know, executing Jews. Like, hey, that's the fucking role.
It's the movie,
and I'll win an Oscar. So, but there were people, particularly because of BLM, you know, they were just like, man, this might be, this could be bad.
Right.
You saying this, like, on film, that could be really, and I heard people say that, and I just kind of, I don't buy it.
Right.
Nor do I think that people watching film are going to be like, how dare they.
That actor.
I think a white comic saying the N-word on stage.
Right.
At this point is pretty. It's pretty taboo.
Right. Because you don't have to say it.
You don't have to. I mean, I know that Louis C.K. did back in the day. And Neil Brennan had. But now it's sort of like, You don't need right. to. You don't need to. What are you going to get other than like, oh, I'm so edgy that right. I do
it? FYI, I'm Puerto Rican, so I can say it.
You can't.
Legally.
Yeah, that's one of the rules. Yeah. So, but like, I know that, like, and the first editor that I set yeah, yeah. you up with, I know that he was like weird about having his name.
Yeah, he didn't
attached.
Even want his name attached to it.
It's fucking
and
crazy.
I was okay with it. I'm like, because
great,
I,
less credits.
Like, yeah, fine. Because you know, I ended up giving it to another editor. Who, yeah, thank God, I found like that was a miracle.
That's
it was a
great,
fucking
man.
Miracle.
And we can say Tommy Wayfield, who's actually the
he's a great guy. He was a great guy. I just think honestly, editors like. They're good editors that edit this, as editors that edit that. I just think this might have not been the thing he is great at.
Yeah, yeah, yeah.
This particular kind of story. And it took a while. He's a busy guy. I'm a busy guy. It was going to take forever.
Yeah, yeah.
So I put an ad out, and I was like, I hate doing Craigslist ads and things, but I found this cat.
On Craigslist?
Yes.
Wow.
And the reason, and I was going to choose these other, there's a girl. I'm like, you know, I'm going to choose a girl. Maybe work with a girl. Then there was this black editor, or maybe a black actor.
Yeah.
And then, but they were all young, like, yeah, I can edit kind of, they were like Tommy's, like Tommy was, but yeah. You know, I'm sure they were good editors, but just, I don't know. And then this guy was like, I'm a professional editor, da 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 da. And I was offering very little money because I had no money left for this project. And because I paid Tommy exactly what I told him I was going to pay him. Deal's a deal. And he goes, I'm also a sound designer. I'm like, fuck yeah. Ding, ding, ding. That's it. I get kill two birds with one stone. Because,
yeah.
You know, for those of you that don't know, it's when you shoot a film, editing and all that's great. But sound is so important.
Oh, God, yeah.
And if you don't know what you're doing... It becomes an ugly mess, and you have to fix a lot of things. This guy knew how to do both, so I met with him, and he was kind of not weird, but he was quirky in a weird way, and like a nerdy kind of way.
Maybe
and
on
I'm
the
like,
spectrum, which is
kind of just you know, like, nice guy, love him, and he's extremely extremely talented. And so anyway, I left him. I left him to drive with all the info. And I went home, and my girlfriend knows that it's been taking forever. It was months and months and months to edit this thing.
Yeah.
And I go, I think this guy's going to have something for me by tomorrow. And she goes, what? I go, yeah, I think. Because Tommy actually gave me a cut. He gave me, it was more like an assembly cut than anything.
Yeah.
So Jack, the editor, Jack Sherman, very talented guy. If you need an editor, hire him. He gave me something together, and that's when, like, when I looked at the assembly cut, it was okay. It was just like,
did I make
anything.
A boring film?
Yeah. But then when I saw Jack's cut, I'm like, yes. Like, yeah. I was like, that's the direction. That's the direction we want. And then I tried his patience because I was like, let's tweak this, let's tweak that, let's tweak this, let's tweak this. And there were a couple things we wanted to fix later, and you know, there are times where, you know, you guys hand each other something and then it's in the wrong hand. And I'm like, fuck, how are we going to fix it?
Yeah, yeah, yeah.
But luckily, I also know editing. And I would come up and, like, flip the image around, trim this part. And we'll get tighter. I'm like, all right. And it worked. I'm like, there you go. And then, you know, and then he would come up with stuff and I would do stuff. And then on the punches, like when he's beating you, I removed frames from the punch. So it looks real and it looks super fast.
Yeah, it does.
It painful. And the way I learned that trick from another project I did, and what you do is you just remove frames, so all of a sudden it just looks like a violent punch. And
yeah.
Really, it's not. It's just you know it's slow punch, but it looks violent. And then you know we had the blood and you're spitting out the blood, so everything just looked perfect. So anyway, it looked great. It was we finally got a good cut, and then we did our screening with the other people, and then. Like you mentioned something that, like they go, yeah, I'm kind of just my character looks like he's just driving, not looking. I'm like, you're right, because it's written like you're looking for stuff. So I went back in. I'm like, Jack, do you mind if I mean, of course, you know, I had to pay him again and everything, but I'm like, but he was doing it great. I mean, he did it great. And then we trimmed some other stuff, and then thanks to you, you know, I was able to get a colorist to color it because it's very difficult lighting. A black and a white guy,
yeah,
together.
Mm-hmm.
You know, especially when you have a very harsh light. And the harsh light was supposed to be that way because it's supposed to look like a street light, right?
Yeah.
Or alley light, whatever. But I didn't want it to be as bright as it was, but we had to have it bright. But then the shadows were really heavy,
yeah.
Which were great, but I didn't want them that heavy. And there's no way to do regular, like use a LUT. If you use a LUT, it'll work on some things and not others. And
yeah.
So then I had the opportunity to do what's called DaVinci, for you guys want to know. And that's how all professionals use DaVinci to color movies and television. And so I was able to do that. And it's so much better, prettier, yeah. It's cleaner. I was happy when I got it back. And then that had a lot of issues too, because we didn't shoot it for that. So we had to like resize the shots. Because it was really shot in 6K, then it was brought down to 1080, and then we had to bring it up to 4K. Wow. So we had to change sizes to everything, and
yeah.
We had to. And then when you change sizes and you do certain things, and you take it from one thing, another program, now the zooms aren't in there,
yeah.
And the effects aren't there, and it was just like back and forth. I'm like, you fix this, but now this is fucked up, and it just took forever, and then. I'm like, this is done. This is finally when it was locked. I'm like, it's fucking locked.
Yeah, yeah.
Don't leave.
And then I give you a note. How about this, Joe? You're like, shut the fuck up.
No, but I thought about it, and I would think, anytime you give me a note, like I worked some of them, but other ones I'm like you know, the thing about the, like the pictures is nothing I could do. I would have to literally get someone with After Effects to do that.
Yeah, yeah, yeah.
But like even the pictures, one of the things, like your character has two kids, right? And because of the way the picture was in the wallet, you don't see one of the kids where the wife is holding it. I'm like, ah. But I know there's a kid there. You see his little arm, but that's about it.
Yeah.
But that's why also I go, okay, originally I had two inserts of each of the wallets, but then I cut it to one. So it's less obvious and less whatever. Yeah. But it's fine. Like, luckily, the remarks the worries that you had about the pictures, I haven't heard it from anyone else.
Okay.
Like, if I would have heard it from other people, I would have been like, oh, fuck, he's right. But it's also because it's you know.
Yeah, yeah.
And
yeah.
I think, I know it's Photoshop. You know, you know what I mean?
Yeah, yeah, that's true. Yeah.
And, but it's.
And even if the pictures do, for some reason, land funny, mm-hmm. And this is what a note I got from someone is like a little funny, like, it's kind of good because they're like, it's really fucking heavy.
Yeah,
and there's a little like levity in these photos.
But even when you're lying, when he says, when you're talking to him and Eric's character, and you're like, well, when I don't want to, I thought if I called you the N-word, and he goes, N-word? N-word? You gave me 10,000 niggas, and now you call me the N-word? You're like, I don't want to be rude. and that's the way, like, I wanted your characters to be laughing.
Have a little rapport, yeah.
A little influence. Because there was no bad guy and no good. If anything, it's actually you're more the bad guy, even though his character is the bad guy, right?
Yeah.
So, but it's more like something both your characters are just doing whatever you have to do for your family, man.
Yeah.
And when you're desperate, you don't think. Because people
you don't think about people, what you're going to do to other
wouldn't
people.
Wouldn't that guy know that? I'm like, no.
Yeah.
He's fucking desperate.
Yeah.
He was planning to die that day. Now he's not going home. He knows he's got to die. He's not going home. So what do you think? He's planning shit? Like he's thinking logically? Of course not, right? So I didn't buy that when someone brought that up. But it was a film person, like logical. Like,
no, I teach at this college.
I'm like, no, it's
yeah.
But so many films you could go, come on, or this. A lot of my films, things could be different ways. Like, for instance, in Missing, that horror film I did, there's a lot of hints that they're cannibals, but they never say it, and you never see it.
Yeah.
But there's hints of it. In another film I did, there's other hints. And in this film, there's other hints. Like, you don't know what happens to Eric's character, right? You think maybe he gets away with it, maybe he doesn't. Because there's an argument for both ways.
Yeah.
You can say, oh, well, he was a felon. There's fingerprints. There's DNA everywhere. I go, yeah. But if he's also a felon, he also knows how to get away with it.
Yeah.
And he didn't do anything wrong.
Yeah.
And if the shit hit the fan, everything that Eric would tell the police can be verified.
Yeah.
He was sick. He was dying. He took money out of the bank.
Yeah.
He was trying to find somebody to kill him. He has a wife. He has two kids. da da da. His wife is pregnant. How would he know that? You know what I mean? There's so many ways that he get away with it, even if he did get in
people,
trouble.
It starts conversation afterwards too.
And so what I was going to do, and I thought of this too late, so I probably couldn't have done it. But I go, but then I'm going, no, I don't want to do it. It's too on the nose. Is during the credits, I was going to have like if you're here listening to the news,
yeah,
where you know, white man Chad Miller was found, da 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 da. Police call it a homicide, which gives you your character what it wanted.
Yeah, yeah.
And it goes, no suspects at this time.
Interesting.
So then it'd be like, oh, okay, he did get away with it.
Yeah.
And I'm thinking that's too. I'm putting it too on the nose there.
Yeah, you know?
So I go, fuck it. No, I want people to wonder.
Yeah, that's good. I like that. Well, listen. So, first of all, thanks for coming, man. This is awesome.
Me, man.
We are going to be at the Pasadena Film Festival.
Yes,
right?
Yes.
And how can people, if people are listening there and there, how can they see it? Or
yeah, if you want to see the film, which I would love for you to come see the film. It's in Pasadena at the Lamar. How's it pronounced? Lamar Theater. L A E Lamar. Oh shit.
Lemley.
No. Is it Lemley? Oh Lemley. My god! I sound like such an illiterate. Lemley Theater. It's a Lemley Theater. It is on. What's the date again? I see. Was it? It is the 12th.
It's Monday. It's Monday. The whatever the Monday coming up is. Yeah.
No.
This Monday, we're so stupid as comics, we have no idea what the date is.
It's the 13th. It's
Monday the 13th.
September 13th at 6 p.m.
Awesome.
It's a Monday. And not just our film, it's a bunch of other short films, so you get to see them. And I'm pretty sure we're doing a question and answer. You can meet Eric, you can meet Bill, you can meet myself. And there'll be a question and answer for all the films there, so it's going to be fun. And please come out to support. But you get your tickets online, because if you don't, it will sell out, because that's what film festivals always do. So get your tickets now. As soon as you hear this, go online at Lemley and get your tickets
if you're in the Pasadena area.
That's right.
Awesome. Well, thank you for coming, Joey Mandina. I hope we get to work together again.
Well, I'm sure we will, brother. I'm sure we will.
Awesome, man. Have a good night. Bye.